Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz. Today is October 7th, 2016. As always, I ask you to join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com, to like us on Facebook at Commentary, to follow us on Twitter at Commentary. I'm at J. Podhoretz. With me, as always, at Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And at Noah C. Rothman. Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So, with the election 33 days away, the revelations about Hillary Clinton and the emails and the behavior of the Obama administration do not cease. And whether or not they have any material effect on the outcome of the election is really beside the point at this point, because we are seeing a kind of endemic corruption, self-dealing, and effort to quash any serious reckoning in relation to the question of the compromising of national security by Hillary Clinton's homegrown, homebrew email server in the latest batch of Freedom of Information Act email releases, secured, I believe, by Judicial Watch this time, that suggest intimate White House involvement with the management and handling of the email story from the very beginning, just after Hillary Clinton's disastrous March 2015 press conference at the United Nations, at which she claimed that there was no server, there was a server, there hadn't been a server, she hadn't done anything wrong, maybe something wrong had happened, she didn't know. It wasn't her, it was above her pay grade, it was below her pay grade. And the big question, of course, in the subsequent year, year and a half, is that the congressional committees investigating have been pushing and pushing and pushing to try to find, to make a kind of comprehensive timeline of what happened and to see what possible violations of not only the law, but of national security took place as a result of this reckless behavior. And more it's clear that the Obama administration from the beginning took up the matter because it had to, and took it up in a way that was designed from the get-go to quash any possibility of anyone being held to account for this behavior. Noah Rothman, you've been following this pretty closely. What can you tell us about all this?
Yeah, the most damning elements of this most recent release, overall, step back a little bit, 30,000 feet, is that Hillary Clinton's nascent campaign was coordinating with the White House in order to make sure that some uncomfortable questions about this thing were not asked, and they were all on the same message. And that coordination was going on with White House communications director at the time, Jennifer Palmieri, who went over to the Hillary Clinton campaign shortly thereafter and became a Hillary Clinton campaign staffer, a communications official. The most damning email, I think, in this exchange that was released is between Palmieri and then State Department spokeswoman Jennifer Psaki. Actually, no, she's not State Department spokeswoman anymore. She used to be. Famously of the hashtag campaigns.
Right, yeah.
Who
was an Obama 2012 campaign spokesman who came across a little bit like a valley girl.
Right, the Russians are not abiding by the promise of hashtag, I believe was the quote.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, they were communicating, and one of the emails to Psaki from Palmieri said, between us on the shows, referring to the Sunday shows, think we can get this done so that he being Secretary of State John Kerry, is not asked about email. And that didn't happen. John Kerry appeared on the Sunday shows, and he was not asked about Hillary Clinton's email scandal, despite being the Secretary of State succeeding Hillary Clinton in that position. A day afterwards, Psaki emails Palmieri, good to go on killing CBS idea. CBS Face the Nation was the show on which John Kerry appeared. And we are going to hold on any other TV options, just given the swirl of crap out there. Nobody knows why John Kerry was not asked about this particular issue, despite it being very newsy and relevant. And it's not clear, according to the Wall Street Journal's reporting, how Jennifer Psaki could influence CBS News so that she could execute her will and make sure that nobody asked these uncomfortable questions. But I think everybody listening can put two and two together.
Yeah, the two and two are the Rhodes brothers. Ben Rhodes being Barack Obama's chief foreign policy advisor, and David Rhodes, his brother, being president of CBS News. And as we know, Ben Rhodes is not above bragging that he can pull the strings of the media like like a puppeteer and they marionette, since he did that in David Samuel's now notorious piece about the selling of the Iran nuclear deal. So we don't know who did what. We also know that the kind of general liberal view of the email scandal was that it was a fake, it was a phony, it was a fraud, it was ginned up by right-wingers who were obsessed with the Benghazi, and they stumbled on this, and it had nothing to do with anything, and, you know, that it was outrageous that anybody, you know, on the one hand, they had to investigate it because, of course, the Obama administration prosecutes people for behavior like this, has prosecuted seven people in the course of its administration for security violations of this sort, and indeed attempted at one point to sort of loop in or lasso James Rosen of Fox News into one of these investigations, into a leak, and the question of whether or not there was an unauthorized exchange of information or the mishandling of classified information. I think, as I wrote a couple weeks ago, that should Hillary Clinton lose, which may or may not be a likely proposition, Democrats will have to ask themselves very straightforwardly whether or not their bubble mentality about how just because right-wingers were upset about Benghazi and then discovered that Hillary Clinton had put national security at risk, made the Hillary Clinton putting national security at risk issue a right-wing conspiracy problem to be dealt with the way liberals deal with all right-wing conspiracy problems, which is to mock them and poo-poo them and roll their eyes and not do much investigating into them, whether or not this is the thing that will bring Hillary down if she is brought down, and it will have brought her down legitimately. The secondary point I want to make is that when James Comey, the FBI director, came out and said he was not going to indict Hillary Clinton because no prosecutor would indict her on behavior like this, that was self-evidently at that moment patently false. There have been multiple prosecutions of people for the mishandling of classified information. Somebody went to jail for 5 years during the Bush administration for having driven a document to his country house in West Virginia and having it there as opposed to his house in Arlington, Virginia, because his house in West Virginia was beyond the 25-mile limit established by the law as being the acceptable distance from which you could bring you could carry a classified document away from Langley, away from CIA headquarters. So what he said was preposterous, and he also said that, and now we have immunity being granted to machines, we have the refusal to subpoena anything, and
that's what we need to have the fullness of this picture, is that more information has come out over the course of this week, which you alluded to, regarding immunity deals for Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson in order for them to receive a laptop that had a lot of information on it, which they agreed they wouldn't search after January 31st of 2015, before any of this came out in the public, and also which they would destroy, despite having obviously evidence on it. If you extend an immunity deal to somebody, you think that they're a witness to something that could possibly be a crime, and yet they were allowing her to serve as Hillary Clinton's counsel. Cheryl Mills. And that also prevented them from investigating this whole bleach bit thing, which is Paul Combetta, who's a technology contractor, and he used some software to erase so that it's information from the server so that's forensically unretrievable.
Well, the amazing thing about this overall is that it's not like we're talking about one breach or one misstep that's now being pounded over and over. It's growing tentacles. It goes into It starts with Benghazi, and then it involves these White House communications, and then the emails themselves implicate the Clinton Foundation, and then there's the Comey statement, which gets the Justice Department involved as well, and everything that went on with Loretta Lynch and prior to Comey's statement, and now we have the TV networks involved as well, and then there's the private firms and Bleachbit. It's becoming this unwieldy sort of scandal.
Well, it appears that the reason that this immunity was granted in exchange for these machines was a deliberate decision by the Justice Department of the Obama administration not to impanel a grand jury that could, in fact, issue the subpoena request to impanel a grand jury to help along with the investigation that the FBI was attempting. So it turns out that all of this was going on without a grand jury. And so for the FBI to get information, this information had in some sense to be given up voluntarily since there was no compulsion. No effort was made to compel witnesses either to testify or to provide evidence. It was all, you know, by request. So when they preemptively say, okay, we'll let you look at my laptop as long as you destroy it afterwards, the decision is made to agree to that and to immunize the information on the laptop because there is a deliberate decision has been made by the Obama administration to make sure that no criminal proceedings are going to follow from this investigation. That is the only way to look at this. And this, of course, follows the refusal to do a serious criminal investigation into the behavior of Lois Lerner at the IRS and the destruction of emails on her part and the refusal to do serious investigating into the Fast and Furious scandal, the gun walking scandal in which weaponry seized somehow makes the hands into Mexican drug dealers and border agents get shot. There was at the Justice Department, and one wonders why it would only have been the Justice Department, a deliberate decision to assume that it was legitimate that any investigation that involved congressional committees getting all hot and bothered, Republican congressional committees, was to be stymied, blocked, slow-walked, delayed, and impeded. We're probably never going to get the answers out of this that we need, but we have at least three cases now in which this is self-evidently the case. It is very, very disturbing, and it is very frightening. And if you think the whole point about the misuse of executive power is that when it is misused, it creates a new precedent for its misuse by future administrations, that will say, well, they did it, so I guess we get to do it. No one stopped them, so who's going to stop us?
And the backdrop of all this is Americans are in the midst of a crisis of confidence in their institutions, and those institutions are just displaying every day why that crisis of confidence is prudent.
Right. Well, there are two different forms of this crisis, right? One is the belief that the authorities are incompetent at handling things, made most plain by the horrific, first 2 weeks or first 3 weeks of the rollout of the Obamacare health exchanges when the websites didn't work and all of that, which was some kind of, you know, libertarian fever dream of what would happen when government gets involved in anything. So that's the incompetence thing. And then there was the malfeasance. There is the simple question of whether or not rules are being made that make it possible for people in power to cover up for themselves and others. And in this case, I think what makes it different from previous corruption matters and other administrations and local and state governments is that those are usually kind of venal in the sense that they're about, you know, hiding money laundering or bribery or, you know, personal aggrandizement and all of this. And a lot of this just seems to be nakedly partisan and ideological. That is, Republicans say X. Not only are we permitted to say Y because they say X, even if what X is true, but we are then permitted by the nature of how bad we think they are and how untoward we think they are to behave illicitly because we believe their investigation is illegitimate. Therefore, we are allowed to use whatever means we can to stymie their investigation. That is a terrifying precedent. They won't say that that's what they're doing, but you can't look at Comey's behavior and say that that's not what happened. Comey was, you know, basically blinking SOS in that press conference. He was saying, you know, I'm not going to throw the election. You can't look at me. I'm standing here. I'm not going to be responsible for changing the course of American history by myself. Well, I'm here alone. I got an attorney general who's meeting with the husband of the target of this investigation 6 days ago.
And 6 days ago on a tarmac.
And saying balls, and then it's like, okay, you do it. So I just don't think you can blame Comey for being the person who said, "Look, I can't do this by myself."
That was also the same dynamic that, I mean, you can't really prove this, but it's my inclination that same dynamic informed the decision, one of the various decisions, deciding the constitutionality of the individual mandate to Obamacare in the Supreme Court, is that they didn't want to interfere in the political process by adjudicating that case as it should have been, strictly on the merits of the law, and instead of doing so, rewrote the law.
He said, I mean, the decision all but says that.
Yeah, which
the
is...
The decision says at the end of it, there's an election, you don't like it, vote somebody else in.
Right, precisely.
That's how John Roberts ended the Obamacare decision.
So the headline to all this, of the course of the Obama years, is that we're compromising ourselves, our constitutional duty, and our institution in service to the idea that the sovereignty of the American people can't be violated, even if their sovereignty is elected a series of corrupt officials.
It's pretty dark. And of course, you know, the fact that the end result of all this is a Republican nominee who has literally no interest in separation of powers or the First Amendment or restraining the role of government in our lives is itself a kind of bizarre emanation of the same result. It's like, you know, it's like, okay, none of you could do anything to stop the Obama people, so what we need to do is, you know, make a golem out of mud that will make a monster who will defend us from this monster, basically.
Right. Well, I mean, and the thing is that any remotely articulate Republican candidate could look at all this and deliver an effective message that, wow, this is, you know, Trump's inarticulate message is, oh, this is all fixed, everything's rigged. But, you know, once again, there is a very legitimate and scary and depressing argument to make about how things actually do need to be cleaned up and all these unsavory interconnections.
But I also think that you have to blame Barack Obama in this sense. March 2015... a rational White House thinking about its responsibility not only to its country, but to its party and to the future and, you know, of its legacy and all of that, looking at Hillary Clinton at that press conference, should have said, oh man, we are in big trouble. This is big trouble. This server is big trouble. There's a lot of big trouble ahead here. Maybe we ought to do something about not coronating Hillary Clinton. Maybe we ought to try to help create some realistic alternatives. And as it was, an alternative came up out of nowhere that almost beat her, you know, got 45% of the Democratic vote, a 74-year-old socialist from, you know, from Vermont. So, you know, if that had been Biden, if that had been, you know, a successful Democratic governor or something like that, and the White House had made it clear that it wanted a race, it didn't want a coronation, and that it even hinted that one of the reasons was that this whole issue had to be adjudicated publicly to make sure that the party was not compromised, that would have been the rational and sober and responsible thing to do. As it is, if Hillary Clinton wins in November, there will be a giant shadow over her coming administration. I don't care what people say. This doesn't wash away. It doesn't go away. The stories aren't going to go away. These court cases are continuing on the FOIA request and on material and information. There are cases that are going to be heard after November. You know, she's not out of the woods. I mean, she's out of the woods in terms of the Obama Justice Department, and she certainly, her own Justice Department isn't going to indict her. But who knows what could happen?
You know, your point about the Obama White House sort of moment of sobriety is interesting, because I think, to my mind, if you see the most, if you, Barack Obama looks so completely unsure of himself in that moment when he is first asked, when did you know about the homebrew server? And he says, I found out about it with the rest of you, as we then came to find out is not the case, because he has emails in there under
well, we pseudonyms. We don't know what's the case. So he has evidently a pseudonymous email address that appeared in the Hillary email release. That said, that he has a pseudonymous email address doesn't mean that he has a homegrown server or that he knew where the email was going. It just means that he has a pseudonymous email address. So I think some of this is being overread. I mean, you know, it's just, the idea was he has to have a way of communicating. Now, by the way, he's the president of the United States. If he, this is where these things get complicated. All power of the executive branch and the rights reserved to the executive branch and the co-equal status of the executive branch resides in the person of the president. It does not reside in the executive branch. The executive branch emanates from the president, who was an elected, who was the one elected official voted on by all the people. If he chooses to have a pseudonymous email address, moreover, if he chooses to have a private homegrown server or to use AOL, he is permitted to do so. That is not a violation of law. He is the person from whom all things like, you know, how documents are classified, it's all invoked in the name of the President of the United States. So that's why he can declassify anything by saying declassify it. He is not ruled by classification measures. Hillary Clinton is. She is not the president. She is not elected by anybody. She is responsible to Congress in a way that he is not responsible to Congress. Her department is overseen by congressional committees. She is not a co-equal of Congress. He is a co-equal of Congress and of the judiciary. If he wishes to choose to treat her as such, that's all well and good. It's simply not the case. It's not the way the law is done. Now, with all that highfalutin stuff, getting down into the raw nitty-gritty of politics, R. Noah Rothman wrote a post earlier this week that is creating an unusual amount of buzz about what happens should Donald Trump lose.
Typically, I write things and they don't go anywhere.
We all do. That's the whole point. Is that, you know, it's like how many hits, you know, you record an album and, you know, there are 14 songs on it and one's a hit. So your post is about what the Republican Party should do in the event of a Trump defeat. You want to sort of lay it out a little bit?
Yeah, I was thinking about this over the holiday, and I've been thinking about it since January, I suppose. I've been writing on the theme for some time, because the writing was pretty much on the wall that Donald Trump was going to have a very tough time of this election, and it does look likely that he's going to lose. In the event that he loses, there's a lot of fantasies on the right, the anti-Trump right, the pro-Trump right, about purging elements within the party that they dislike. And that's a fantasy and a noxious one, and it needs to be abandoned. The party as itself is not a nationally viable vehicle unless it's a national coalition. That means every single member, it turns out, needs to be a part of that coalition, and there needs to be some sort of reconciliation. And as a result of that necessity, that everybody's going to have to discover terms upon which they can reconcile, at least at the grassroots level. And that essentially is going to be very lenient. I don't think that there's anything that anybody can demand, save for the fact that we acknowledge that Donald Trump's nomination and his approach to governance was a mistake, and that everybody involved in that mistake needs to accept that, acknowledge it, and on those terms we can have truth, and from truth we can have reconciliation. Some examples will have to be made. Those who gave aid and comfort to white nationalists, for example, members of the K Street establishment who thought Donald Trump would be a more safe steward of the comfortable order of things than somebody like Ted Cruz, and some conservative performance artists who have shielded him from a lot of criticism that he deserves. But those are very minimal. For the most part, there needs to be a lot of magnanimity here and coming to together. And that has that notion, very lenient terms, I think, for throwing a winnable election. But that notion has irritated particularly those who believe that Donald Trump has hit on something, that he's really speaking to those for whom the GOP's agenda in Washington has left them behind. The notion that tax cuts are an effective idea of policy and they exist in on their own and are should be appealing to a grassroots coalition of conservatives is unsatisfying and demonstrably flawed. According to them. And I don't think that's inaccurate. But at the same time, and then there's also a lot of people who believe that because I said that Donald Trump's coalition of white working class voters is likely to lose and thus affirm the findings in the quote-unquote autopsy, the Growth and Opportunity Project in 2013, which had recommendations about minority voters and women and young people, the Obama coalition, there's a lot of people who hear amnesty. And that is a bizarre pathology. Nobody said anything about immigration reform, which is likely to get done in Hillary Clinton's first term. So Republicans need to get over their fear of quote-unquote amnesty. They've lost that fight. But the idea that reform conservatism has no place in this future in which there's some sort of reconciliation between Trump voters and conventional traditional Republicans in the Beltway is not true. It does. There certainly needs to be some sort of a policy consensus there. But all this needs to be predicated on the idea that Donald Trump was a flawed candidate, that his ascension to the nomination was a mistake, and everybody involved in that needs to accept that failure.
Okay, so first of all, the performance artists that you talk about, meaning, you know, what Nathan Wurtzel calls the entertainment wing, or we're talking about, you know, the radio talk show hosts and people on Fox and stuff like that, they're not going to get punished. No one's going to get punished there except commercially, except if their ratings go down, except if they, you know, flip out in the wake of this and start getting nutsy and having their audience run away from them in embarrassment or deciding that they've been selling them a bunch of snake oil and they turn away and get embarrassed. So I think, first of all, the people who need to sort of be made an example of is not going to happen, at least in the way that will pain them. Secondly, the K Street establishment that wanted Trump instead of Cruz is the Senate Majority Leader. Now, if the Republicans lose the Senate in the course of a Trump loss, Mitch McConnell will lose his leadership position. He won't be the Senate Majority Leader anymore because Republicans won't have the majority. And he will no longer be the leader of the Senate because he will be voted out. So that may happen, let's say. But, I mean, he's the object lesson. He's the person who, out of personal pique, said that Ted Cruz was impossible, but maybe we could kind of control Trump. As for the people who helped the white nationalists, see, this is where the real question of how you interpret Trump's rise goes. Are we going to say, as say David Frum says in The Atlantic, that Trump saw something and that what he saw effectively was a more moderate and liberal Republican electorate? That's his line, that they, even though he's anti-Trump and he doesn't like Trump and he's written some very good stuff for us on some of these matters, that he, and about the whole question of Nixon and Trump and the connections there too in 1968, he says Republicans are a lot less religious than they used to be and they want cradle to grave health care and they want a more powerful social safety net and they're not interested in tax cuts. But they don't like immigration and, you know, that. Okay, so that's him. I mean, that's David. I don't know. Maybe it's them and maybe it's not them. But I see no indication based on any polling, any data, any information that suggests that the Trump coalition has any policy, you know, is backed by any hardline policy on anything except immigration and the wall. None, nothing.
exemplified by the fact that they defend him no matter what side of any of policy he's on.
Well, that's right. So that's the sort of leadership. That's the people who have bought in. I'm talking about now the grassroots supporter, you know, the people who are enthusiastic about him. We know that they like the wall, and we know that they think that America has gone down the tubes and that, you know, everything is terrible. So that's what we know. We don't know that they want cradle-to-grave health care. We don't know that they want this, and we don't know that they want that, and we don't know that they want anything. We know nothing. All we know is that he is a candidate of national resentment, and sometimes candidates of national resentment express something very potent and powerful that has policy implications, but sometimes they don't. And the notion that you can glean or discern a serious set of policies to be pitched to the Trump voter to get them back into the Republican fold or to solidify them in the Republican conservative fold is preposterous, because if what they want is cradle-to-grave health care, 75% of the Republican Party or 80 or 90% of the Republican Party does not like Obamacare, wants it blown up, does not believe in nationalization of healthcare. It was the unifying glue of the right for the last 7 years that Obamacare was both a policy and a constitutional abomination. They don't want, you know, I mean, you know, they, so
it's because of his intentional vagueness and contradictory statements that you can project onto him all your priors, all your desires to see conservatism embrace Medicare expansion, which he does. And that's, we don't know. Like you say, we don't know whether people actually like that or not, but we know there's a certain branch of commentary that does.
So there are two
political commentary
parties in the United States, just as there are two ideological tendencies in the United States. One is toward the ever greater role, size, and influence of government on American life, and the other is less. And if the Republican Party is not the party of less government involvement, now that doesn't necessarily mean that you then, you know, close cabinet departments. That's been a mantra for 30 years, and it doesn't happen. What it does mean is that when liberals start trying to use, you know, Title IX and Title X to change criminal justice procedure and suspend the idea that, you know, you're guilty, you're innocent until you're proven guilty, then someone's got to stand up and say no. If you eminent domain, someone's got to stand up and say no, the government doesn't have the right to seize your property, you know, at will, which of course is something that Donald Trump does believe in. So if we go down the road of accommodating the Trump voter in policy terms, you're going to destroy the entire basis on which there is a non-liberal, non-democratic tendency in the United States.
Well, here's a question that I'm trying to wrestle with.
Aside from white nationalism, which is way more important than people realize. If it weren't, then his entire vote wouldn't be white and male, you know?
Well, conservatism has been the philosophical ethos of the Republican Party for a while, but not for a long time. I mean, historically, this was a progressive party. This was a party that didn't shy away from interventionism in the public sector, or interventionism in the private sector from the public sector. And progressivism may be its natural home.
I don't think that's right. See, I think that there were two tendencies in the Republican Party before Reagan. One was the sort of growing Reaganist tendency, which was a kind of anti-communism mixed with a sense that government was getting too big and that liberty was what united these ideas, that government was encroaching on our liberty at home, just as communism was encroaching on liberty in the world. But it was opposed not by progressivism in the Republican Party. It was opposed by green eye shade budgetary seriousness. That is, we have to take in just as much as we can't spend more than we take in. And you have to be very careful and very accountant driven. And, you know, you need to be responsible so you don't need to be handing out tax cuts too much. But on the other hand, you have to make sure that the books are in balance. And those were the two forces. Main Street Republicanism, which was, you know, small business banker, you know, small town banker, you know, I know how to be sober and responsible and keep my books in balance versus the America is a grand, glorious experiment. The experiment is in danger from, you know, communism abroad and from encroaching leftism at home. And those are the two. Now, these may not really count anymore. Certainly, green eyeshadism is totally out of favor, even though you would think with a $20 trillion debt, it would maybe start coming back in. What is out of favor is any sense of a connection between America's role abroad and its condition at home. That has been severed. And so people like us are saying, we're looking at this, you know, 500,000 people dying in Syria and the vibrations and emanations of it spilling out all over the Arab world and into Europe. And if America is not there to stop it, who is? And basically much of the country, including both candidates, saying, well, we can't. Yeah, I mean, we're going to try to help when we can, says Hillary. Or Donald Trump says, yeah, we just want to bomb the hell out of ISIS. And that's it. Like, that's where things are different. And reforming this Liberty Coalition, that's the thing that seems to me to be the sort of gargantuan hard sell of the next couple of years.
The tying in with sort of national and international and sort of domestic greatness was really largely a result of the Cold War. I mean, Russia was a threat abroad and communism was a threat at home, and it was brought together in that sense. Where, you know,
well, and then the 60s, when the McCarthyist, or when the general sense that we might be being undermined internally kind of faded in the mid-50s, then when the 60s came along and the leftist radicals arose, and you did have actually some serious revolutionary activity inside the United States, not only from the sort of student revolutionary left, but from sort of, you know, black activists and the Black Panthers and people like that, and the sort of regularization of crime and all of that stuff, it came back. But it was very much a condition of the Cold War. Yeah. But a sort of longer Cold War, not right. just... Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, back to Noah's post and the idea. I mean, the interesting question is, in a post-Trump reconciliation, I get the sort of who gets back in, who we forgive, who we make an example of. But I agree with you, John. There doesn't seem to be no obvious core of ideas around which we're then going to coalesce.
No, there's only one, and that's the big right. question. So the one big idea around which the Trump people, you can say, coalesce is anti-immigration, almost to, you know, immigration to zero, or immigration to the wall, or immigration to, you know, the sense that, or, you know, what binds Trump's foreign policy? So you build a wall against Mexico and you keep Syrians out, and somehow it's all the same, somehow it's all a species of the same thing.
Well, here's why I'm a little less concerned about this than I think you guys are, as far as coming back together. In a vacuum in which only Republicans existed, yeah, it would be difficult. But we're all going to be back in the same foxhole at the end of 2017. 2018 is going to come around. There's going to be a lot of Hillary initiatives that are going to need to be blocked. The midterms are going to be a substantial problem for the Republican Party. They got a really great map, and there's going to be a lot of people who are going to try to primary their incumbents and create some sort of a Trumpian fringe, I think, in that process. So there will be some uniting in 2017 just by virtue of the fact that it'll be an opposition party again. And they'll come back together on those terms, which is why I think we need to be thinking right now about how we reconcile the Trumpian deviation. And that consists of acknowledging that it was a failure.
But I totally agree with you. But telling them to acknowledge it's a failure is that's a hard sell. That people
today, now,
people aren't going to do it anyway, because no one ever acknowledges that kind of failure. I mean, a lot of people who said, look, I had to say that I was supporting him because, you know, there were 30% in my district. There were, you know, 40% of my district was going to vote for him. And what was I going to do? Like, you know, like be on the wrong side of my own voters? That's one thing. But I do think that in general terms that reconciliation is fine, but if the Republican Party does not have a fight over being the party of small government, does not fight for itself as the party of small government, as the liberal progressive move of the Clinton administration will be on every front, both by entropy, by Obama and entropy, and then by what she's promised, largely pushed to the left by Sanders, you know.
Well, that may be the implicit admission in acknowledging the deviationism of Donald Trump. But the easy way to go about that is to say that he was racially inflammatory. That's the entry level there. You say that his rhetoric was abhorrent and that he alienated parts of this coalition that we need. That's the easiest thing you could possibly say. Then you can move on to the fact that he was a progressive and a Manhattanite liberal every way.
That's where it gets tricky. Because one thing that I think that everybody has to acknowledge, that we did not wish to acknowledge, and that we were discomfited by having to acknowledge, was the fact that a naked white appeal as a white against minorities, and was a key element of what made this appeal real. And, you know, it's not just don't count the rallies are not representative of the gigantic national electorate, but they're representative of something. And the media from which he emerged, you know, not just Hannity and Fox and Friends, but the National Enquirer, InfoWars, the World Wrestling Federation, all of that stuff. These are the entertainments and the information sort of conveyances of, you know, what might be called the white lumpen proletariat, totally ignored by people like us, totally ignored by most people. But the idea that, you know, 10, 11, 12 million people are consuming this stuff every day, every week, and that, you know, you spend 5 or 6 years making yourself a household name with them and a friend to them and someone that they hear all the time and who speaks to their concerns, that's a very serious thing. And you can't just say, okay, well, you know what, he was racially inflammatory. Well, so you're right, he's racially inflammatory, because the racial inflammatory part was a key element of this. And the part of the problem of rebuilding and bringing the Trumpian, you know, the Trumpians in is if they, you know, if a not small number of them are racists, then they're a bunch of racists, and then you're going to start saying, okay, and here come the Latinos and the Asians and other people, and they don't want them. They don't want them there. That's the whole point, the whole thing, and particularly in relation to Latinos. I don't know how you can look at the Trump agenda and Trump over 16, 17 months and all of this and say that what he was doing was not saying that America has been compromised by the rise in the population of people who come from Spanish-speaking countries. I mean, that is the ultimate idée fixe of Trumpism. And, you know, that's when he said we can't be so politically correct. When he says we can't be so politically correct anymore, what does he mean? He means, I'm going to say that this country is too Mexican, and I'm going to say that Muslims stink. And if those two messages are messages you want to hear, you're going to hear them from me. Life is so politically correct that I can't even say it that directly. So I'm going to say it in code words even now, but you'll hear me. I don't have an answer to this. I'm just saying that, you know, it's just not so simple. But
no,
you do make
to me
a
like
key
a gateway
point.
to identify it in those terms.
But your key point is a key point, which is something that the right has had a problem with forever, which is that parties are about addition, not subtraction. A party, not an ideological movement, not anything like that, which is not about numbers. But a party is about getting the most people to agree to it and go into it. And the simple fact of the matter is the Republican Party has been shrinking, not growing. It achieved parity in 2004. It's now 7 to 9 to 10 points behind Democrats in terms of the way people identify themselves in 2016. That path is the path of people who think it's mean, it's not nice, it doesn't represent me, they don't talk about anything that I'm interested in, and I'm embarrassed to tell my friends that this is who I vote for. And if the Republican Party cannot be a place where people, if it have to be something where people slink into the voting booth to vote for it without telling anybody so they don't get yelled at, that's the greatest advantage the Democrats have. The greatest advantage the Democrats have is if you go on Facebook, It's people saying, if you tell me you're for Trump, I'm not going to be your friend anymore. And they mean it. And, you know, maybe Trumpians say that to about their liberal friends, but that's a very, very small group of people. But this has now become an acceptable way to talk in social media and probably in life.
And you know, there's another element here, which is something we've discussed before, which is about how the Republican Party, when it's winning, is made up of a successful conglomeration of coalitions, different types of conservatives who want different things. And when it's losing, and a post-Trump lost GOP is a losing GOP, the elements of this coalition do not want to work with each other. They see no benefit in the trade-offs that come from that. And that's
why a lot of these questions will come out in the wash. We got to see what the returns are like on November 8th.
Right.
We have to, in order to fully diagnose what the problem is. So I guess we can't really say much of anything until we see what the demographic breakdowns
are. The comedy is, if you really, really go science fiction and you wanted to flip this around and you say, okay, well, what happens if Trump wins and what happens to the party if Trump wins? Again, the impulse is going to be a purge. Only in this case, it's going to be the Trumpian purge of everybody else. Just at the moment when Trump and the Republicans can least afford to purge. They can't afford to purge. They can't afford to throw people out. It will be a close won victory. You know, things are going to be very hard won. You're going to have 100% media opposition to you. And the notion that what you do is say, all of you rhinos, get the hell out of here, is pretty crazy. That's number one. Number two, Democrats, what do Democrats say if they lose? What are they going to say? Well, the easiest and smartest thing for them to say is, what the hell happened here? We nominated the one person that Donald Trump could beat because she was morally compromised, because she was old, because she had nothing to say, because she has no purpose. She had no purpose. She had no vision. And she's a crook. So, but that doesn't solve any of their ideological problems. And then they'll be pushed way to the left. And we'll have this kind of bizarre situation in which we have a way to the left Democratic Party and a way to the populist Republican Party. And what on earth is the vast middle going to do? Because that's still, just because our politics is polarized doesn't mean that the country is polarized. The country isn't that polarized. I mean, you know, everybody watches The Big Bang Theory. I don't know. I mean, it's not that polarized. You know, we're in a very strange political moment. So that's the other joke, is to think about who's going to deal with what. And by the way, if the Democrats win and they then feel comforted that Hillary really put it all together and everything's fine now and they can just go on and be triumphalist as they so deeply want to be, and she sort of waltzes off with her sense of the world undimmed, God knows what horror she is going to impose on people, not just ideologically, but just in terms of her own personal behavior and bills and what kinds of things they're going to generate that, you know, are going to tear this country apart. So, with those wonderful sentiments, we come to a close. I hope everyone who is listening, who knows what I'm talking about, has a wonderful and sweet New Year, Umatuka, and that you have I was going to say have an easy fast, but we'll probably talk before we get to that. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. You get a few free reads, and then we ask you to buy a subscription for $19.95 or a full on all points bulletin subscription for $29.95 that gets you our iPad and a beautiful monthly magazine. So for Abe Greenwald and Noah C. Rothman, I am John Podhoretz, and keep the candle burning.